Welcome to Dower in Orbit, the Practical Design Leadership Podcast.
My name is Ethan Marcotte. I'm known in some corners of the industry for coining the term responsive web design. The reason I think I'm here today is to talk about my latest book, You Deserve a Tech Union. I've been writing about labor issues in tech for the last few years, and this book came out August of 2023. Looking at the trend of tech workers actually realizing that they can organize around issues that are important to them and in many cases actually form unions in the workplace to have a greater say over how they work and the conditions under which they work.
So Ethan, responsive web design to tech worker empowerment, that's quite the transition. What was your journey like for that?
I guess I see a little bit of a through line there in that, first and foremost, like, unions are something I've always kind of cared about in the abstract. I didn't grow up in a union family, but I was always cared for and taught by union members. And so, like, I understood, like, on an abstract level that this was an important thing, but didn't really end up mapping it directly to the tech industry when I joined it. I think with a lot of us, we, especially around that time, sort of thought about the industry as somehow distinct, something new, and we'd sort of like fixed a lot of the issues that other industries had to deal with. But at least when I was writing responsive web design, a lot of it was about improving access. I think that, you know, we'd been thinking about designing for the web through a very narrow lens, that it was anchored to desktops, that it was, you know, something that we were tailoring to specific screen resolutions, to a specific kind of browsing context. And when the mobile web really exploded in Western markets, around 2007, 2008, that kind of demonstrated that the control we told ourselves as designers, as practitioners, that we had over the medium was a little bit false. So responsive web design was really just kind of trying to capitalize on a flexibility in the medium that was already there that we'd been ignoring. And in doing so, to kind of help, improve equity of access and, actually just, provide better experiences for all of our users. So I do think there's a little bit of a through line there with what's been happening in the tech industry for the last few years, because these workers, and again, like, the book is directly informed by research and interviews kind of across this labor movement in tech, who have been actively working to address issues in the industry that we've known about for quite some time, but they're actually moving to organize around them, to collectively repair these things. In some cases, that's actually forming unions. In many cases, that's forming unions. And that, for me, is an incredibly powerful story. And so I think there's a parallel there just in terms of, like, how we sort of approached our work in one level or another was a bit of a narrow vision and sort of excluded a number of experiences or people. And the way that we address that is just by thinking about our work a little bit differently.
Yeah, I certainly appreciate that. And I can't imagine a more timely topic than unionizing and worker power, given the near daily reports of mass layoffs in tech. You know, just skimming LinkedIn provides a microcosm of viewpoints on the why, both from a non-hierarchically senior perspective, as well as those in management. And I'm paraphrasing here. Is it, you know, retribution for the brief power in the market employees held during the Great Resignation? Is it tech having lost any sense of moral compass, giving corporate profits our record highs? Or is it, you know, air quotes, just business? You know, the concept of power with an organization, who has it, who wields it, is core to You Deserve a Tech Union. And the book, which is a brilliant and fairly quick read, arms you with the tools to build a labor movement that's focused on protections and safety and power for tech workers. And I'm going to bring this mega question home in a second. A fair amount of the framing in the book on leadership is from potential adversarial angles and how to navigate them. Are you navigating union busting? Is it a potential lack of support at senior hierarchical levels, etc.? And since the lens of through which we discuss topics on this podcast is design leadership, I thought it'd be interesting to flip things a little bit. And to that end, how can design leaders support a labor movement and solidarity through action internally?
For folks who haven't read the book, there's a couple things that I think could maybe be helpful. One is it's written predominantly from a U.S.-centric mindset, which is not to say it doesn't have applications in other countries. I tried to make it as accessible as possible. The reason I mention that is because in the United States, our labor laws are very antiquated, and the relationship between management and workers tends to be pretty oppositional, I think was the word you used. Workers do actually have to fear retribution in a lot of different forms when they try to organize, not even actually forming a union, but just speaking up in the workplace is a very risky proposition. I think a lot of that is because there's a more than a century of history built up around that relationship. What I think we're seeing now is an almost unprecedented upsurge in support for labor across nearly every industry, not just in tech, but also in tech, which means I think that people in a position of leadership, people in a position of power, do have an opportunity to recast that relationship as something that's more productive rather than antagonistic. Harvard Business Review, which is not exactly the most left-wing publication, wrote an article about this last year about the need for labor-savvy leaders. And we've seen instances of this in the tech industry. Glitch, which was one of the first labor unions in the modern tech industry, their leadership didn't try to fight the union drive when they found out about it. They immediately recognized the union and sat down for negotiations. So there's, again, you know, there's still this idea of folks sitting on opposite sides of the table trying to represent their interests, but they're doing so in a productive way rather than trying to fight a union drive or fight work organization at every turn. So ultimately, I think that's, those fights are damaging, not just for the worker management relationship. They're also damaging for the company's brand. And up until now, I think businesses have been very comfortable accepting that cost. And I do think that we're coming to the end of that.
The reframing from something leftist to something that actually has to do with respect, admiration, even for people's skills, to use it as something quite attractive to work at a place that has a strong union and acknowledging its part in innovation and creativity. Has that helped with upper management in welcoming these types of discussions?
Well, I would love for that to happen. I would say by and large, there hasn't been a ton of data to point to. Well, I guess one recent development that does come to mind is here in the United States, there's been a massive wave of organizing and union drives at Starbucks. You know, it's really sort of like a grassroots drive to store by store to form bargaining committees. Starbucks at a corporate level has been incredibly aggressive in fighting those drives, pursuing a number of different tactics. And this has been going on for years. So one thing that actually did happen this week was that the union and corporate actually reached a joint statement about trying to actually engage in productive discussions for the first time, that they'd, you know, reached some preliminary agreements on some, let's say, conversational sticking points. Again, it's a very short statement, but the fact that there was that statement is a huge milestone. Now, it's going to be incredibly important to see what happens next. It may not go anywhere, but I think we're starting to see instances of some of these corporations, some of these leaders recognizing that this is, they've been adopting a failed strategy, trying to oppose their workers who are actually asking for, again, more of a say at work. Another great example would be Microsoft entering into kind of a non-aggression treaty with a major union here in the United States, the Communication Workers of America. So that provided some cover for, you know, unionizing QA workers at some of their game studios. Again, I think these are early days to sort of like speak definitively about that, but they do feel new, especially at that level, for companies that size, actually recognizing that this is something that they can't continue to fight against anymore.
The international aspect is interesting. Is it a challenge for a company that employs a lot of people outside of the US, where they might be much more open to unions, to fight it in certain markets?
The one thing that comes to mind is I do think that there are some strategies that are emerging in terms of how these workers do organize across multiple international lines. I guess the one thing that comes to mind immediately is that, you know, again, I'm writing from a very US-centric context, and in many other nations, including Sweden, maybe especially Sweden, labor law is much more mature. Access to unions is significantly easier. But I guess the one common thread that I've seen with folks that I've had conversations with is that the common thread across pretty much any market is that tech worker saturation in those unions is pretty low, generally speaking. That there's still this sort of understanding that tech work is somehow privileged and distinct. I do think that's changing, but you know, there has been some interesting activity, like Klarna, I know, for example, in Sweden has been having some contract disputes and organizing disputes with their management, including a number of strike threats, I think, to, you know, again, try to bring them back to the table to resolve some of these discussions. So this is all to say that I think that this book is written in a very early stage of the tech industry's labor movement. Things are still evolving very quickly, in fact. I'm as interested as anyone else to see where things go next.
That's great. And I think the book, even though you've written it from a predominantly a North American perspective, actually carries a lot of value in markets, for example, like Sweden. Because what we're seeing here is that there is a different type of aggressiveness against unions from companies importing a different region's or a different nation's approach to unions and using it to sort of validate their own approaches. And sometimes it's actually driven by business realities. A business might actually be registered in a country which makes it difficult for them to have the types of union dialogues they would normally have. But still, the topic is relevant everywhere. No one has really achieved the nirvana around this. And that's why I personally think the book is relevant across a much larger geographical area than it was intended.
That's incredibly nice of you to say, and that's validating to hear. I'm really glad you mentioned that point, though, about the intentionality of where companies decide to do business and how they incorporate, because I do think that that's a very common tactic today. You know, I talk about this a little bit at the end of the book, but the tech industry's reliance on contracting firms to do certain kinds of tech work, whether that's order fulfillment or social media moderation or providing training data for large language models. Most of this predominantly happens in countries that have minimal labor laws and minimal protections for workers.
Thanks so much for that, Ethan. We appreciate your time, your expertise, and of course, joining us on this podcast.